Hello, and welcome to Light the Way with Dr. Colin Monger. He's the senior pastor of Shepherd of the Hills Calvary Chapel. At Light the Way, we believe the most powerful tool we possess when sharing our faith with others is the Word of God. It was the Apostle Paul that said, "Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the Word of Christ." So as we open the Word together, it's our prayer that you'll not only receive what God has for you, but share what you learn with those you come in contact with. And now, here's Pastor Colin.
Would you turn in your Bibles this morning as we go to Genesis chapter 39? Genesis 39. We're in a series that we have called From Genesis to Jesus. And we've been looking at some of the major stories in Genesis that kind of let Jesus shine through in a sense. We looked at creation and how it was Jesus who said, "Let there be," and then there was. We then went forward to the Garden of Eden, and it was Jesus who's promised in Genesis 3 when God says that the seed of the woman would rise and crush the head of the serpent. We then went forward to Noah and the ark, and we see that it's Jesus in the ark, that he is the one of salvation, he is the way, that there's one way in, that there's one hope, that in him we have safety and comfort, and that we're sealed by God. And so we saw all of that happen in Noah's ark. We then went forward to the story of Abraham and Isaac and how God called Abraham to give him his son Isaac to test his faith, but that God never actually planned on taking Isaac's life. Instead, he would give his own lamb on the mountain to be sacrificed so that Isaac could live. And so what a great testimony it is of the ministry of Jesus on the cross. Now, for the past couple of weeks, we've been looking at the story of a young man named Joseph. Perhaps the most Christ-like figure in all of the Bible. And it is in Genesis 39 that we pick up with him this morning. I heard a story of a husband and wife that were walking through the shopping mall, and they were just doing the normal thing until a certain point when this beautiful young woman in a red dress just walked right on by. Well, they're there, and the husband couldn't help but notice. And so before long, he realized that he was now staring at her as this woman had walked by their path, and he shakes it off. He realizes what he's been doing. He looks back at his wife, only to find out that she has been staring at him the entire time. And she looks at him and says, "Well, I certainly hope it was worth all the trouble that you're in." Of all the battles a person will face in life, perhaps none is more powerful, none is more difficult than the battle of temptation. And rest assured, there has never been a single person alive who has not faced temptation in some way. Even Jesus himself faced temptation. And there has never been a single person, except for Jesus himself, who has not given in to temptation in some way. The fact is, being tempted is a natural part of life. It doesn't mean you're failing, it means you're a human being. The Bible says in 1 Corinthians that no temptation has overtaken you that isn't common to all. Every single person will fight this battle. Whether it's a politician in Washington or a banker on Wall Street, the pastor in the pulpit is tempted just like the person in the pew. You could live the life of a monk in a monastery and you would still face temptation. In fact, it's such a normal part of life that Jesus even told us when you pray, pray like this: "Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be your name." And then at the very end of the prayer, he says, "Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil." Whatever your temptation is, whether it's money or food or the flesh, some people are tempted with new clothing and fashion and beauty and status and cars. Others might be tempted by books or movies or electronics or music, some kind of amusement. Some people are tempted by sports. Whatever it could be, everyone is tempted by something. In the book of James, it says that each person is tempted when they're lured and enticed by their own desires. And so every one of us will face temptation in life. I love what the Apostle Paul said in Galatians 5. He says, "For the desires of the flesh are against the spirit, and the desires of the spirit are against the flesh, they are opposed to one another. Now, as good as that verse is, I really love how it's kind of paraphrased in a different translation you might not be familiar with, but it says there, the sinful nature wants to do evil, which is just the opposite of what the Spirit wants. And the Spirit gives us desires that are the opposite of what the sinful nature wants. These two forces are constantly fighting each other, so you are not free to carry out your good intentions. That is temptation in a nutshell. And the world would say, just give in. Just do what makes you happy. Just follow your heart. Just get yours. Live your best life now. Just give in to your temptation. And yet, there is overwhelming evidence to suggest that doing that very thing rarely yields a positive result. And there's certainly no shortage of people with ruined lives who will tell you all about it. How giving in to their temptation ruined their marriage, or it ruined their family, or ended a career, or cost them their home because they gambled away the mortgage payment, or how it landed them in jail because they were tempted by something they shouldn't have been doing. Or they contracted some disease, and now they're in a doctor's office, and the doctor is saying, I'm sorry, but there's nothing we can do. You only have a couple of years. And so all that to say, the battle of temptation is real, and it is one of the most difficult you will ever face in life. That's the bad news. But the good news is this. It is winnable. And we see in chapter 39 here a story of a young man named Joseph who fights and wins the battle of temptation. Now, the last time we read about Joseph was a couple of weeks ago. We took a couple weeks off to look at the Reformation. But you might remember Joseph's life. When we last saw him, he was still living at home. He was about 17 years old, and you might even remember that his brothers hated him because he was the favorite. It even says in Genesis 37 that Jacob loved Joseph more than the other sons, and because of that, they couldn't stand him. They couldn't stand the air that he breathed. They didn't like anything he had to say. They couldn't stand him at all. And then to top it off, Joseph was given special treatment. He didn't have to work the way they had to work. He was given this coat of many colors, which even further cemented the fact that he was different, that he was somehow favored among them, even though among those 12, and I know there's another younger brother named Benjamin, but from Joseph on up, he is the youngest of the brothers that are involved in this whole thing. And so they look at him and they say, he gets this royal robe. He doesn't have to work. He gets the favorite spot that the firstborn should have had. So it goes on to tell us they hatch this plan and they're going to get rid of him once and for all. And so they take him out to the wilderness. They throw him in a hole. They sell him for 30 pieces of silver to a Midianite trader, which is, by the way, the same price that Judas was given for Jesus. Uh-oh, is right. It's not going to go well for Joseph. I love it. See, they're listening, taking notes. But that was Joseph's life. And he was thrown into this hole. The brothers go home and they tell Dad, you know, a wild animal got him. A wild animal ate him and there's nothing left. Meanwhile, Joseph is on his way into bondage. And that's where we pick up with him here in chapter 39. Notice it says in verse 1, now Joseph had been brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard, an Egyptian, had bought him from the Ishmaelites who had brought him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his Egyptian master. His master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord caused all that he did to succeed in his hands. So Joseph found favor in his sight and attended him, and he made him overseer of his house and put him in charge of all that he had. From the time that he made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake, and the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in house and field. So right away, we see that Joseph is a man of impeccable character. despite the life that he's lived, despite the fact that anybody might excuse him for being a bit bitter, despite the fact that he's now in slavery and his freedom's been taken care of or taken from him, and he's there to take care of this Egyptian master, despite the fact that all of this has happened in his late childhood, he has still developed to be a man of impeccable character. And because of that, Potiphar has trusted him implicitly with everything that he owns. And so I can just imagine how those conversations might even go in Potiphar's home when someone says, hey, Potiphar, how much gold do you have in the house right now? And Potiphar says, well, to be honest, I don't rightly know. You'd have to ask Joseph because he takes care of all of that for me. Well, Potiphar, how much do you spend on food every year? How much are your expenses? And he says, well, I don't know that either. Joseph does all that for me and I don't have to worry about it. Well, Potiphar, what's the code to get into the vault? There's some things we need to look at. And he says, honestly, I don't even have the code to my own vault. I gave that to Joseph. I forgot about it. You're going to have to talk to him. And so Joseph has proven himself to that level. He's capable and loyal and trustworthy to the point that Potiphar has just handed everything of his life over to him. He never has to worry about anything because there is Joseph. And he's taking care of it. And so it goes on to say here in verse 6, so he left all that he had in Joseph's charge. And because of him, he had no concern about anything but the food he ate. But notice how the verse ends. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. And it literally means in the original language that he had a nice body and a handsome face. And certainly he would. He's in his young, early 20s at this point. He's strong and he's able-bodied. And he had an easy childhood, but he has not had an easy adulthood. And he's upright and confident and righteous. He's got a good job and he's trustworthy. He's not a gossiper. You don't have to worry what Joseph's going to say when you're not there. Joseph is the kind of guy that if he says yes, it means yes. If he says no, it means no. And you don't have to worry. Is there anything he's not telling you? He's the kind of guy that ladies talk about when they say, where have all the good guys gone? Well, the answer is they are in Joseph. It says here that he was handsome, but he looked good. He was handsome in form and appearance. And because of that, it goes on to tell us in verse 7, and after a time, his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph and said, lie with me. And so here it comes. This is Joseph's great battle with temptation. The wife, who doesn't have a name right here, but she is the wife of one of the most powerful men in all of Egypt, and she's throwing herself at him. And no doubt she's beautiful herself because Potiphar is rich and powerful, and rich and powerful men tend to attract and marry young, beautiful women. That's just the way the world goes, especially at a time when rich people ate well and they didn't have to worry about being robbed and murdered. If you were a man with wealth and means and power, then you're not going to starve. And so if you're a young lady and you're looking to marry somebody for a successful future, that's who you're looking for. So you get protection for you and food and your family's taken care of and all of your worries of the world just kind of disappear. And so no doubt that is Potiphar's wife, a young, beautiful woman, maybe even in a red dress, walking around the house, throwing herself at Joseph, making a pass at him. And it's not even one time that it happens. It says, if you go forward to verse 10, and she spoke to Joseph day after day to lie beside her. And so this battle isn't a one and done kind of thing. It's not like Joseph's test of life here is going to be a one-question survey. It keeps happening. It's relentless. It's an onslaught. It's every day he goes into work, there she is. Every time he turns around, there she is. Every time he shows up at the office, there she is. Every time they pass each other in the hallway, there's the invitation, there's the temptation, there's the looks. Probably getting physical. It does get physical later. Now, oftentimes, we expect that if we succeed in resisting temptation, it will be over. That we pass the test, and it will stop. We assume that if we flee the devil, he does not chase. That if we resist once, it goes away forever, and yet that's just not how it works. I know a man who quit smoking, and he had quit smoking years and years and years ago. It was something like 40 years, and he told me one time, he said, you know, even after all this time, all these years, not a day goes by that I don't want one. And so that's how it is with temptation. It is relentless. It is day after day after day. And Jesus faced temptation that way as well. Satan tempted Jesus 3 times in the wilderness. Every single day, he faced the pressure of the enemy to give up and quit. It wasn't worth it. When Jesus announced to his apostles that he was going to the cross, it was Satan who hijacked the mouth of Peter to say, far be it from you, Lord, this will never happen to you. And there was a temptation that he didn't need to do it, that it wasn't worth it. Then he was arrested. And the guard said, we're looking for Jesus. And certainly the temptation would have been to say, well, I don't know who that is. Because it's not like they had pictures back then. They didn't have Facebook to look the guy up. That's why Judas had to mark him with a kiss, because they'd heard of Jesus. They knew about all the problems he'd been causing for them. But not all of them had met him in person. And so how do you know Jesus from any other Galilean? The answer is you couldn't. And so the temptation would be to say, no, I've never seen the guy. Or you just missed him. He's you know, he just went to Wawa for a hoagie or something. But Jesus says, no, I'm he. When he was on trial, he was given a chance, defend yourself. But he didn't. Even though the trial was illegal, even though the witnesses were lying and committing perjury. When he was on the cross, people said, well, if you are who you say you are, Jesus, come down and save yourself. And so all along the road, there were so many times that Jesus was tempted. In Hebrews, it says he was tempted in every way as we are. And so here we see that Joseph is tempted over and over and over and over again. In verse 10, she spoke to Joseph day after day. He would not listen to her to lie beside her or to be with her. And so it never stops. It's always there. But notice in verse 8, but he refused. And said to his master's wife, behold, because of me, my master has no concern about anything in the house, and he has put everything he has in my charge. He is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? And as she spoke to Joseph day after day, he would not listen to her, to lie beside her or to be with her. But one day, it says in verse 11, when he went into the house to do his work and none of the men of the house was there in the house, she caught him by his garment, saying, lie with me. But he left his garment in her hand and fled and got out of the house. What we have read is the linchpin event that will define Joseph's character forever. He has faced this battle of temptation, and he has won handedly. There's no doubt about it. Joseph walks away from this victorious. But how? What made him so successful? How was he able to say no to something that has brought down so many other people? What is it that he did that allowed him to win this battle of temptation? Well, there are a few things that we notice Joseph does well that we can take and learn from and apply. First of all, notice that Joseph is clear. Notice the response in verse 8, but he refused. And in Hebrew, it's a word that is the strongest kind of refusal you can possibly give. It is an absolute refusal. In other words, it's not hemming and hawing. He doesn't say, ah, shucks, you know, I wish I could have. He doesn't say, you know, I really appreciate the offer. I just don't think it would be such a good idea. He doesn't stir his foot and say, you know, I probably shouldn't, you know, I'd really love to. You're a beautiful woman and all, and nobody would ever find out, but, you know, it's just probably not a good idea. There's none of that. It just says he refused. Absolutely, positively, no room for misunderstanding. He says no. It's as clear as it can get. It's a red light. it's a stop sign. It's not a speed bump. It's not something he has to then justify in his mind. Under no conditions whatsoever is this going to happen, and so he refused. In the battle of temptation, people often lose right here. They're not clear. They're not clear about what sin is. They don't draw clear boundaries. Someone once said the easiest line to draw in life is the line between 0 and 1. And so it should be, in theory, a simple thing to say, no, that's not right. But in reality, it's not always that clear, because we're tempted by something, and rather than just saying no, we say things like, well, not right now. Or, you know, I'd love to, but not this time. Or, you know, maybe just a little bit, just this once. No one will have to find out. It'll be our little secret. Just one time, but never again. And before we know it, our imaginations are playing with this thing, and we're dabbling in the very thing we know we shouldn't. And it isn't long before we have jumped all the way in. You know, Jesus said, if your right eye causes you to sin, then pluck it out, because it's better to go into heaven with one eye than go into hell with both. And so practically, this means don't toy with things that tempt you. If you're a person who's tempted by alcohol, then please, whatever you do, do not meet your friends at a local pub for lunch, thinking you're just going to get a burger and a Coke and that's all it's going to be. If you're tempted with gambling, then don't go to bingo night at the firehouse. Don't play with lottery tickets. And whatever you do, don't pick Las Vegas as your family vacation. You might not be doing the same thing as betting on the races or playing cards, but you're still playing with fire, and you know that fire can burn. If you're tempted with online shopping, do plastic surgery. Get rid of your credit card. Because I tell you what, I don't know what kind of computer you have, but mine don't have a cash slot. I can't spend dollars on my computer. If you go to a cash-only life and you get rid of a credit card, it'll be more difficult in some areas, there's no doubt about it, but you won't be able to give in to the online shopping. If you're tempted with food, don't go to a buffet. Oh, I'm just getting the salad. No, you're not. They put it next to the ice cream. We're not dumb. If you're tempted with lust, stay away from the beach. At best, it's going to be a miserable time because you'll be fighting your urges the whole experience. At worst, you'll fall into the very thing you're fighting. But nothing positive will come out of that. There's no net gain from it. And notice Joseph here. Notice how clear he is. But he refused. There's no room for ambiguity, no confusion there. He doesn't say, look, I want to talk about it. He doesn't say, look, I don't want to hurt your feelings. He doesn't care about hurting her feelings. He simply says no. And in his mind, that's the end of it. It was Ben Franklin who said one time, it's easier to suppress the first desire than to satisfy all that come after it. And so Joseph is clear, and he refuses. The second thing Joseph does is he remembers that he's been called. Notice in verse 9, he says, he's not, speaking of Potiphar, he is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept anything back from me except you, because you're his wife. How then can I do this? Notice the conviction in the voice. How can I do this? Notice Joseph remembers his position. He knows that he has a special place in Potiphar's home. He knows that he's been trusted and he has access to things that no other person does, not even Potiphar's wife. Joseph knows that when he speaks, it's with the authority of Potiphar himself. He knows that he's been given all of this responsibility and freedom and power. He's an ambassador for his master. Should he be there? No. Does he like it? No. But he's there, and he's been put in this position of great trust. And not just that, but he also remembers that he was called by God. He remembers the dreams. He remembers that He has a special place in his father's heart. He remembers the prophecy that one day God would exalt him above all others so that God could do something through his life. He remembers how the brother's stuff was bowing down before his stuff, and nobody understands yet what that's going to mean, but he knows God has a plan for him. And so with all of that in mind, with all of that on the hook, he asks the question, how can I do this? Maybe others can. Maybe she can. Maybe all the other servants can. But you know, they don't have his responsibility. They haven't been trusted with the keys to the safe. They don't have the authority. They haven't been elevated. So they might be able to do this. Others might. But he says, how can I? The very thing that was designed to tempt him becomes offensive. You know, Jesus said in Luke 12, to whom much was given, much will be required. And Joseph understands that. He knows he's been called. He knows he has a place of honor. He knows that he's been given a place of power. He knows he has favor. He knows the responsibility and the authority, and he knows his relationship with God. And so this very thing that was designed to entice his senses becomes repulsive. And he says, look, others might be able to do that. All the other slaves might be able to get away with that. Maybe their conscience doesn't bother them, but how can I? You know, a lot of people lose the battle of temptation because they're not clear. But a lot of people also lose it because they forget that they have been called to a higher purpose. In 1 Peter chapter 2, it says, you're a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession. The fact of the matter is this, if you have a relationship with Jesus Christ, then you have been called to something higher than yourself. And Jesus said it well. He said, no one can come to me unless the Father has called him. In Romans chapter 8, Paul says that you've been predestined, that you've been called. He says that all things work together for the good of those who love God and who are called according to his purpose. And because of that, people will look at you and they will judge God by what they see in your life. And that means if they look at you and you're out late and you're partying and carrying on and drinking and tearing up the town, they're going to say, well, that's what Christians must be like. If they look on your social media page and it's filled with vulgarity and sexual images and all kinds of things that tear down and pollute, they're going to say, well, that's what Christians must be like. They see you in the community and you're rude to the wait staff and the service people and you're honking at everyone in the parking lot and you're the one that never lets anyone over. And then on the bumper sticker, it says, what would Jesus do? They're going to go, well, not that, but that must be what Christians do. In the office, we're slacking off. We're cheating the time clock. We're taking the pens home, taking the stapler because, you know, we worked there for 28 years and that stapler's ours. People will say, that's what Christians do. Look, other people may be able to do that. But because of our relationship with God, how can we? Even in ministry, there are things that pastors cannot do that church members can do. And we know that. It's just part of the territory. There's parts of our lives that are so public and are under such scrutiny all the time. Yeah, other people might be able to do this, but how can I? I love what Paul says in Ephesians 4, walk in a manner worthy of the calling to which you've been called. And so Joseph asks the question, and I've been thinking about this question all week. He says, how can I do this? If you have ever served in the military, and I know it's Veterans Day coming up this week, so thank you for those of you who have, or if you were in a family of someone who did. I know growing up as a person or as a kid with a dad in the Air Force, there's a sacrifice the family makes, and then, of course, for the service members, you go and you serve, and so thank you for that. But if you've ever served in that capacity, or if you've ever served in a capacity where you're publicly visible and you represent some other organization or agency or anything like that, then you know that your personal behavior is important. And we have all heard the stories of people who have lost their jobs, not because of something they did at work, but because of something they did on their own time. But people figured out they worked for this place, and the place said, well, we can't have them anymore because they brought discredit upon us. And so it's not uncommon at all for members to be disciplined if they do something, which might not technically be illegal or immoral, but it does bring a disservice, and it brings a bad report to the organization that they're with. And they'll say things like, look, other people can do whatever they want. In the military, they say civilians might be able to do that, but you can't, because you represent something bigger than yourself. And so be careful about how you conduct your private life. We have a sign out front on Hoffmansville for the church, and it says two things on there that mean a lot to me. One of them is it says Shepherd of the Hills. And I'll be honest, the name itself isn't that important to me. I mean, what's in a name, in my opinion? But the legacy it stands for is pretty remarkable. Our church has a long history, over 100 years of faithful ministry to the Lord, even when it wasn't popular. We have a long line of pastors who have stood in this pulpit, standing for what was right, even when it cost them everything. We have had people here who have been contributing authors to the NIV Bible and other seminary books that I actually used when I was in school, long before I even knew the connection. We have a history like that. And I talk to people all the time in the community, and they'll say, well, what do you do? Oh, I'm a pastor. Well, where at? Well, at Shepherd of the Hills. Oh, yeah, I know that. When I was a kid, we did VBS there. My parents, they were married there. Oh, we used to do this and that over there at that church. Do you know this person? Do you remember that? And all of a sudden, the memories come. I met somebody one time in a restaurant, just a random encounter with a stranger. And they say, oh, yeah, I remember that church. And so that's something that I have been determined to keep going well. We are not known as a place for politics. We are not known as a place for culture. We are not known as a place for trends. But I'll tell you, in every single person's testimony, when I talk to them, they say, oh yeah, that was a good church. We're known as being faithful. You know, Paul said, I'm determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. And so not only is that our legacy, but as far as I'm concerned, that's also our future. And so that means a lot to me to uphold that. The other thing it says on there, and this is fairly new for us, but it says Calvary Chapel. I mean, fairly new. It's, you know, 8 or 9 years old now, but it's still fairly new. And that's important because of several reasons as well. Ever since Calvary began in the 1960s, it was all about biblical teaching. And they didn't get involved in all the ritual and all the rigor of the liturgies and everything else. They just said, come in, let's praise God and read His Bible and keep it simple. In fact, the motto of Calvary was established very early on, simply teaching the Bible simply. And so it never got caught up in all the causes and the movements and all the things that keep showing up in churches all the time. No, Calvary was all about just being there week after week, preaching the gospel verse by verse, line at a time sometimes, but just moving through it in a very faithful manner. Slow and steady wins the race. And I think about all the faithful pastors of other churches that are out there, and all with that same name of Calvary. And I think how on the surface, many of them look different. You know, our building looks very different than other churches. Inside, we might have different kinds of ministries than other churches, but underneath, they've all been committed to the same thing, and that is a faithful ministry to the Lord and His Word. In Amos 3, it says, can two walk together if they have not agreed? And so I look at that sign out there, and you know, I think to myself, other churches might do. Other pastors might be free to do. Other people might have, other places might say, they might be willing to accept, or they might change. But how can I? How can we? In light of to what we have been called, how can I do this? And look, if that is your only motivation to fight temptation, simply because you don't want to bring a negative light to the church or the kingdom or to all of the Lord throughout the world, then you should know, honestly, that really is enough, especially at the start. You know, I've heard people that say, you know, the only reason they're going to church is just because they don't want to go to hell. And I think that's not a bad reason. I'll be honest. Like, that's a pretty good one, right? In Proverbs, it says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So there's nothing wrong with there. Now, hopefully, we grow into a love for God and not just a fear of Him. But look, if that's all you have and that's what you're clinging to, understand that's honestly enough to simply say, because of all of that, how can I? And so Joseph looks at this and he realizes he's not like the others. He's not like the other servants in the home. He's been trusted and empowered and chosen and elevated. And God has a plan for his life that's going to do great things. Later on in the book, he will look back on everything that's happened and he will say, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good to bring it about that many would be saved. And so he understands all that hinges on his character. And so he asks the question, yes, others may be free to go and do this. They might get away with it. It might just be a minor thing to them, just a speed bump along the life. But he understands he's been called, and so he says, how can I? One last thing that Joseph does that's worth noting is he's convicted. It says in verse 9, how can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? Notice to Joseph, he says, great wickedness. He doesn't try to minimize it. He's not trying to rationalize it. He's not saying something like, well, you know, that guy Potiphar, he's a joke anyway. And if he left me alone with his beautiful wife, he gets what's coming to him. I mean, he should know how biology works. And look, I don't want to be here anyway. And honestly, he bought me and I'm a slave and I shouldn't be. And who is he to do this? And he neglects her. Yeah. And she doesn't even deserve him. He doesn't pay me enough. And I'm a slave and I was betrayed and I've had a rough childhood and all the other things. And so honestly, what's the big deal? But he doesn't do any of that. He doesn't try to make this less than it really is. He looks at it and says, this is great wickedness. This is a horrible, horrible, terrible, awful, horrible thing to do. And truthfully, if we could excuse anybody for trying to justify his position, it might have been Joseph. Because after all, he was treated miserably his entire life. Ironically, as a slave, he's treated better than he was in his own home by his brothers. Joseph was fleeing from his uncle Laban as a toddler. His mother died in childbirth for his younger brother Benjamin. His older brothers that he trusted and wanted to be like and looked up to and followed betrayed him because they couldn't stand the fact that his father chose him over somebody else, something he couldn't control either. And yet none of that even matters. It doesn't come into the equation. He says, how can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? You see, too often we want to try and rationalize sin, and we say all kinds of things that make it sound okay or less bad. We say things like, well, you know, they had a rough childhood. You know, they grew up in a rough neighborhood, and this was their home life, and they didn't have their parents, or they lost their parents, and they just made a lot of bad decisions, and they had bad influences in life, or they've got a disability, or this is going on, and they just never had a fair shot, and they didn't really have a choice in the matter. You know, by the time they got to that point, it really wasn't up to them anymore anyhow, and they're not hurting anybody, so why don't we just give them a pass? And besides, they deserve it. They've earned it. It makes them happy. It makes them feel good. So what's the harm if it's not bothering anyone else? And we start trying to make sin as bad as the hurt that we think it causes another person. And so if we kill somebody, yeah, that's awful. But if it's just some small indiscretion, it's just you and you're by yourself and nobody's going to see. If it doesn't seem like it's interfering with anyone else's life, well, then it's no big deal. You know, somebody once said that people fail in private long before they fail in public. And so here Joseph looks at this and he says, no. Yeah, we might be able to hide it from Potiphar. Sure, there are reasons I could point to maybe justify it in the minds of others. And after all, this is my boss's wife. I mean, who am I to say no to her? I'm just the slave. I'm just doing what I was told after all. No, he says, how can I do this great wickedness? You see, what often we fail to understand is ultimately sin is not against the person It hurts. And sure, it does hurt people. People are impacted. Potiphar would be hurt by this. The wife would be hurt. The marriage would be hurt. When we steal something, it hurts that person. When we kill somebody, it definitely hurts that person and all the family that are left behind. When we lie, it creates a harm. When we breach a trust, there is a pain. So certainly people suffer as a result of our sin, but ultimately it is not against them. Notice Joseph says, "is great wickedness and sin against God." He understands that this sin is against the Lord himself. Potiphar might be the collateral damage, but God is the one he's truly offending. And because of his calling, he has a conviction that says, how can I do this great wickedness and sin? And so Joseph has won his battle. But what can we put in our life? How do we apply this? What strategy can we take away that equips us for our fight? Well, first of all, very quickly, just remember to expect temptation will come. It's a normal part of life. It doesn't mean you're failing. It is the way life is. You are made in the image of God, and Satan hates the Lord and then hates you by default. And so he will send things to tempt you in life. There is no sin in the temptation. There is the sin in how we react to it. And so just understand that these challenges will come. Second, be clear and draw lines around your life and don't go past them. Don't hang around things that tempt you. Don't go over the boundaries. Don't put yourself in situations. Be clear. Third, remember your calling. You know, Paul says those very words in the Bible. He says, remember your calling, brothers. And so remember that. When you go into the world, you represent the kingdom of heaven. And people will judge Jesus by what they see in your life. And so even though others might be able to do that and get away with it, how can I do this? Fourth, have conviction about what this is. This might be a little thing to the world. It might be understandable and forgivable and no big deal, but it is great wickedness to God. You see, if we were to put sin on a chart, we would say murder looks like this. We would say, like, you know, speeding looks like this. You know, stealing the candy bar when you were a kid might look like this. You know, a lot of things on the chart, they're higher, they're lower, depending on the level of harm it causes people. And so we look at sin on a horizontal plane. This one's really bad. This one's just a little bit. But, you know, God looks at sin from a top-down view, and everything has the same profile from the top. And so it might be a little thing to the world, but it is great wickedness to God. And so have conviction. And fifth and finally, if all else fails, if you expected the battle and you drew the lines and that didn't work, and you remembered your calling and that didn't work, and you have the conviction but you still feel the enemy is pressing in, if all else fails, run. There is nothing wrong with running away to fight again another day. Get out of there as fast as you can. In verse 12, he left his garment in her hand and fled. And I imagine she's probably even disrobed herself at this point. And now she's trying to take off his clothes. And so what does he do? He says, you can have the shirt. And he runs out of the room. He fled. And I just imagine the scene of Joseph running down the hall of Potiphar's home, maybe even with his arms in the air with no shirt on. And just think about how foolish that might have looked. How embarrassing it might have been for him to do that and be seen that way. And how tempting is it to just go with the flow because we don't want to be embarrassed. We don't want to be the one that says no. We don't want to be the stick in the mud. But I'll tell you, if given the choice between looking foolish or failure, I will choose looking foolish any day of the week. And so Joseph fled and got out of the house. And he has fought and won the battle of temptation. Father, as each one of us has our own battle, you know what they are. Lord, some of us are tempted in the same way that Joseph was. Some of us are tempted by other things entirely. It could be physical possessions, could be a title, could be pride. We could be tempted by something that we've just attached ourselves to, some idol in our life that we just won't let go of, and we're tempted, Lord. We're just beyond ourselves. We're enticed. We're lured by our own desires. Lord, you know that every one of us will face this, and we know we will also, that these battles will not just stop because we've won once, but rather, Lord, your word says to be watchful, to be ready, because our enemy prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking those whom he may devour. Lord, we know that this fight will not stop until we reach heaven. We know that this battle will rage, even if we may find ourselves in a little bit of a lull. There's another skirmish coming. So, Lord, I pray that you would empower us and you would give us the courage, the clarity, the conviction. Give us the boldness of Joseph to stand up and say no. And I don't care how that makes me look. I don't care what that does to others' opinions about me. But I will not do this against God. Father, I pray that we would have that kind of conviction. Because the battle is real. And the battleground is all around us. And so, Lord, I pray that you would strengthen our armor. Lord, would you use us this week? Would you give us an opportunity to share this with someone else, to encourage somebody who may be feeling a little bit weak in the trenches right now? Father, would you give us safe travel as we leave here and bring us back again as we gather and worship in Jesus' name? Amen.